International lead investigator on the new Amnesty report titled Ethiopia Summary Killings, Rape and Looting by Tigrayan Forces in Amhara. And finally, today, the biggest news. Nermeen, would you like to break it?
A very big congratulations to our dear news director, Dina Guzder, on the birth of her baby boy on February 11th. Welcome to the world, Rustam Guzder Turner.
Rustam, we are so excited about this new little chapter in the family of Peter and Dina and all of us at Democracy Now! That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Has a job opening. Rustam isn't quite old enough yet. For Human Resource Manager, check it out. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your Portland dial, KBOO.FM on your everywhere on earth internet dial. Stay safe, stay sane, stay tuned. KBOO, the best in community radio.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the return of Portland Folk Music Society concerts with artists who tour nationally. The five-concert series starts this month, Saturday, February 19th, with Robin and Linda Williams.
Gonna drink sweet honey whiskey.
Give me a good heavy load. Clear stretch of road, and I'll let that old bulldog run.
The Portland Folk Music Series has one show every month through June. The concerts will be at the Reedwood Friends Church on Southeast Steele Street in Portland. For information, go to kboo.fm and click on Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Nicholas Kristof's quest for governor comes to an end early, stopped by the Oregon Supreme Court. How is our immunity from COVID-19? We take a close look at how far we've come. And will new legislation open up the rights of militias in the Pacific Northwest to a much more dangerous level? Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 17th, 2022. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks for joining us. Oregon State Supreme Court announced its unanimous ruling today. Former New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof will not be on the ballot for governor. The justices decided that he did not meet the state constitution's requirement that candidates for governor be residents of Oregon for at least 3 years before an election. Here's how he responded to that decision today.
The Supreme Court has spoken, and while we're disappointed with the decision, we respect the justices' ruling, and we thank them for their thoughtful consideration of these issues. This ruling ends my campaign for governor of Oregon, but I want to be clear that I'm not going anywhere. I've been an Oregonian since I was a kid picking strawberries and raising sheep as an FFA, as in 4-H and FFA project on the family farm. And I'll be an Oregonian until the day I draw my last breath and my ashes are scattered on that family farm I love. and on the Pacific Crest Trail here in Oregon. And it's because I love our state and care so deeply about our shared future that I'm going to keep fighting for these issues that we campaigned on, because the challenges are grave and so many people around us are struggling. The desire to serve this state led me to join the race, and I'm not going to stop addressing these issues, whether my name is on the ballot or not. Over the past few weeks, as the court was deliberating, I was continuing to travel the state, listening to voters. And what I heard over and over was that they're worried. They're worried about a housing system that has left too many people struggling to put a roof over their heads. They're worried about an economy that seems to be growing more unfair by the moment, providing fewer opportunities for Oregonians to live the good life. They're worried about an ever-increasing number of people who simply can find no shelter. They're worried about a criminal justice system that too often provides neither public safety nor justice for people, no matter what we look like or where we come from. And people are worried about a climate emergency that is already disrupting our lives with extremes like 117 degree days or those Labor Day forest fires we remember. They're worried about a future of decline and drift in Oregon, and they know something needs to change. I joined this race in part because I saw people close to me who were struggling because of a political system that too often refused to take on issues because they're hard.
And that was Nicholas Kristof's response. Now, Oregon Secretary of State Shamia Fagan's office won the argument at the state Supreme Court. After the announcement of the ruling, Fagan gave her remarks.
I'm Shamia Fagan. My pronouns are she, her, and I am honored to serve as Oregon's 28th Secretary of State. Today, the Oregon Supreme Court unanimously upheld the Election Division's determination that Nicholas Kristof is not eligible to run for Oregon governor because he has not yet been a resident within Oregon for 3 years as required by the Oregon Constitution. First, I just want to thank the court for their quick and decisive action. I also want to thank Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum and the attorneys of the Department of Justice, including Solicitor General Ben Gutman, for their partnership in this case. As Oregon's chief elections officer, I have a responsibility to apply the rules fairly. It doesn't matter what political party you belong to. It doesn't matter if you're a well-funded frontrunner or if you're a political novice. Everyone will be treated fairly by the Oregon Elections Division. Today's decision affirms the standard that state and local elections officials have long used to determine eligibility to seek elected office in Oregon, an objective standard that is based on fact. As noted in the court's decision today, quote, the Elections Division correctly emphasized that it's not their role to determine whether any candidate is sufficiently Oregonian or to examine the depth or sincerity of a candidate's emotional connection to Oregon, unquote. This matters. This matters because subjectivity in election law has an ugly history in Oregon and across the country of preventing people of color and women, immigrants, and other historically marginalized people from full participation in our democracy. I am delighted that we are moving forward with a clear, objective standard for Oregon election officials to apply. As a champion of voter access as a legislator and now as Secretary of State, I am also delighted that Oregon's strong legacy of voter accessibility remains intact. Today, the court confirmed what we knew all along.
And again, there was Oregon Secretary of State Shamia Fagan. Though we may never totally reach herd immunity, COVID-19 immunity rates are high in our country. KBOO's Josh Salem has the story.
According to a model from the Institute of Health Metrics, 73% of Americans are now immune to Omicron. That number could rise to 80% by the middle of March. The calculation is based on the following. About 50% of eligible U.S. residents have received booster vaccinations. There have been some 80 million confirmed infections with coronavirus, and many cases were never confirmed by testing and reported. These exposures help us prevent or shorten illness with Omicron and potentially other COVID variants. Less coronavirus should circulate the population, and new waves will have lower peaks, according to experts. COVID is still infecting about 130,000 Americans daily and killing 2,000. 80 million Americans remain vulnerable. The previous thought that herd immunity would offer near complete protection really no longer holds. New variants keep emerging, immunity from vaccination is waning, and many reject vaccination altogether. But the U.S. is no longer immunologically naive to COVID as it was 2 years ago. Life is slowly returning to pre-pandemic normal. States are lifting mask mandates, airlines are full, and many workers are returning to the office. Different regions may have different levels of protection because the infection rate is as low as 50% in some areas instead of 73%. Ali Maqdad, professor of health metric science at the University of Washington, says, quote, "The 26% who could still get Omicron right now have to be very careful. We've reached a much better position for the coming months, but with waning immunity, we shouldn't take it for granted." End quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
With a U.S. Supreme Court decision looming on the Mississippi 15-week abortion ban case that could decide the fate of Roe versus Wade, some states are looking at telemedicine abortions as an option. Those states include Washington. Lily Volke reports on how it works there.
With the Supreme Court decision looming on the Mississippi 15-week abortion ban case that could decide the fate of Roe versus Wade, new telemedicine abortion providers are springing up in 25 states, including Washington state. The FDA recently removed the long-standing restriction on mailing mifepristone, which opened up the opportunity for clinicians to provide abortion pills by telemedicine and mail. Dr. Deborah Oyer with Cedar River Clinics in the Seattle area says telehealth provides convenience to all patients and thinks it's especially important for people who live in rural areas.
It allows somebody to be in more control in every way. They're in control of their time, they're in control of who knows, they're in control of where they pick up their medications, if they pick up their medications. You know, my goal always has been to have more patient-centered care even before that was a thing.
Oyer says appointments can typically be scheduled quickly in 1 to 3 days and take about 30 minutes remotely. She says patients usually can receive the pills within 2 days by mail or on the spot by coming into the office. In Washington, state-regulated health insurance, such as Medicaid, is required to cover abortions. And even with telemedicine as an option, not everyone has stable internet connections or cell phone service. Oyer's clinic last summer opened a telemedicine satellite site in Yakima, where people who live in the eastern part of the state can come in to use the technology for appointments. Oyer says Cedar River Clinics has seen a 79% increase in medication abortions since they added telemedicine during the COVID-19 crisis.
Early on, it was the safety of the pandemic. But to save time, I don't have to get time off. I don't have to get a babysitter. For all of our telemedicine appointments, so it felt like we were meeting their needs in a way that was very appropriate to them.
She adds that while in-person abortion patients automatically get an ultrasound unless they opt out, the vast majority of telemedicine patients do not need one or a condition that suggests something could be off. Oyer emphasizes that abortion is a common and safe procedure, in contrast to pregnancy and giving birth, which can have significant health risks. She says while abortion requires extensive, informed consent, the same is not true for pregnancy itself.
And the risk of having a baby, even with no medical issues, even being young and healthy, is so much greater than the risk of having an abortion. And no one understands that because what they believe is people die from abortion from back in the day when the mob was doing abortions and people without training were doing abortions. So the lack of understanding of how common and how safe abortion is just shocking to me.
Oyer says whether a patient has an abortion in person or over video, the clinic is there for them afterwards. There is someone on call 24/7 if patients have questions. This story was produced with original reporting from Carrie Baker of Ms. Magazine. This is Lily Bolke with Washington News Service.
A bill repealing restrictions for banned private militias had a hearing in the Idaho House Transportation and Defense Committee this week. As Eric Tegenoff reports, critics say this bill sets a dangerous precedent for armed groups in the state and throughout the Pacific Northwest.
Idaho lawmakers are considering a bill that would repeal restrictions on banned private militias. Paramilitary actions such as parading in public are barred under a state law from 1927. Private militia groups also are prohibited under the Idaho Constitution, which states that the military is subordinate to civil power. that is, the governor and legislature. Adrian Evans is head of United Vision for Idaho. She says this bill would set a dangerous precedent at a time when the country is bitterly divided and could embolden anti-government armed groups in the state.
To wield their minority influence at the barrel of a gun is not the kind of thing that I think anyone sent our legislature to do. People want our systems to work for us. They don't want rogue actors to destroy a system and to put our entire system in jeopardy.
Major Steve Stokes, general counsel for the Idaho Military Division, introduced the legislation and says his agency identified repealing the provision as part of Governor Brad Little's Red Tape Reduction Act. Stokes says the law is antiquated. In support of the bill, a spokesperson for Little says he is a strong supporter of First and Second Amendment rights. Although open carry of firearms is allowed in Idaho, Stokes has acknowledged the bill does not violate the First or Second Amendments. According to a report from the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection at Georgetown Law, every state in the country has a constitutional provision or state law banning private militias. Evans says paramilitary groups have become normalized and even mainstreamed.
But we can't afford to allow that to occur. We have to maintain the code. We have to maintain the social fabric. We need to maintain our moral and ethical standards.
At a public hearing on Wednesday, Sandpoint Mayor Shelby Rogenstad stated his opposition to the bill, saying it could endanger public safety as well as law enforcement. He described a scene from 2020 when Sandpoint High School students supported the Black Lives Matter movement were overrun by heavily armed paramilitary groups. For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at public.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact on Birth Justice and Black Maternal Health. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. At 8, listen to Ear to the Streets of Portland. Tonight's weather, some clouds, a low 36 degrees. Tomorrow's weather, intervals of clouds and sun, a high of 53. As for the weekend ahead, not looking too bad. Saturday, some clouds, a better chance of rain on Sunday. Highs in the mid-40s, lows in the 30s. Today in history, on this date in 1801, Thomas Jefferson was elected our third president. So our quote of the day is from Thomas Jefferson, who said, "Pride costs us more than hunger, thirst, and cold." President Joe Biden is unswayed by attempts to influence his Supreme Court pick. The U.S. State Department warns a Russian false flag misinformation on Ukraine. And the Centers for Disease Control weighs new COVID guidelines as the Omicron surge wanes. With more on these headlines affecting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
He is not going to be swayed by public campaigns or public sniping or lobbying efforts.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says President Joe Biden is tuning out political lobbying efforts to influence his Supreme Court justice selection. According to the White House, he has narrowed the field to 4 as yet unnamed candidates to replace outgoing Justice Stephen Breyer. The State Department is warning of potential false flag operations by the Russian government. State Department spokesperson Ned Price told reporters Wednesday the Russian military was spreading false reports online and across state media, which he says could serve as a pretext for an invasion of Ukraine.
It could involve claims about Ukrainian military activity in the Donbas, false claims of U.S. or NATO activities on land, at sea, or air, even claims of Ukrainian or NATO incursions into Russian territory.
The Donbas region is located in eastern Ukraine. A coalition of more than 100 congressional Democrats are pushing the Biden administration to investigate treatment of black migrants into the U.S. Last fall, immigration officials deported thousands of Haitian migrants who entered the country via the southern border. The mass expulsion, which included graphic images of border agents capturing Haitian immigrants, drew swift backlash from social justice and immigrant rights groups. In September, Vice President Kamala Harris called the event troubling.
What I saw depicted about those individuals on horseback treating human beings the way they were is horrible.
As the Omicron surge ebbs, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, says health officials are weighing guidance for the next phase of the COVID-19 pandemic. She says any call on loosening guidelines will be tied to future metrics, including hospital capacity and transmission rates.
We want to give people a break from things like mask wearing when these metrics are better, and then have the ability to reach for them again should things worsen.
Congress is considering a proposal to send $50 million annually to Native American tribes to help preserve wildlife migration routes, which have been disrupted by human development. Shaylin Miller of the Native American Fish and Wildlife Society says the proposal would simultaneously ensure safe migration routes for animals while also reinforcing tribal sovereignty to manage the corridors.
Tribes are severely underfunded and at a huge disadvantage due to extremely limited resources, especially when compared to state or federal wildlife agencies.
President Biden has ordered the White House visitor logs of former President Donald Trump to be turned over to the panel investigating the January 6th insurrection. Trump previously claimed the records were protected under executive privilege. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Jonah Chester, and Eric Tegadoff contributed reporting. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Some landlords have denied veterans housing based on their sources of income from federal and state benefits. Now, some hope to change that is coming from Colorado lawmakers. They're looking at creating some new laws. One would give veterans protected status and fair housing, and another would give tax credits to those who contribute to nonprofits that help the houseless. Eric Alatas talks to a coalition for the homeless to find out more.
A bill making its way through the Colorado legislature would make it a lot harder for landlords and home sellers to discriminate against military veterans. Kathy Alderman with the Colorado Coalition for the Homeless says HB 1102 would still allow preferences to be given for new housing construction and vouchers for veterans. She says the past few years have made it clear that investing in veterans pays off.
You can reduce it significantly. And I think everybody can agree that people who have served this country deserve, at the very least, basic access to rental and for home ownership opportunities, and probably even some kind of enhanced access.
At least 1 in 10 people experiencing homelessness has served in the armed forces. Veterans frequently face housing discrimination due to stereotypes, including substance abuse and mental illness. Alderman says access to housing is critical for struggling veterans to recover. HB 1102, which would add veterans as a protected group under the Colorado Fair Housing Act, has cleared the House and now moves to the Senate. A separate measure aims to encourage more investment from the private sector. HB 1083 would provide a 25% tax credit for individuals who make donations to nonprofits, including Colorado Coalition for the Homeless, that provide housing, shelter, and services for people experiencing homelessness in urban areas. The credit would be 30% in rural communities.
And that's because our rural areas have traditionally had significant barriers to accessing funding resources. They don't have a lot of government land that can be donated for these types of projects. And so we think that the bump to 30% in our rural distressed areas is appropriate.
Alderman believes the two measures, combined with Colorado Governor Jared Polis's proposal to invest federal relief funds into homelessness resolution, are key tools for addressing the state's homeless crisis.
To making sure that we are getting more people into safe spaces and into housing, and that it aligns really nicely with investments in affordable housing coming from the federal government and investments in homelessness resolution as proposed by the governor.
This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
A Native group is funding a South Dakota state position to target the tragedy of missing and murdered Indigenous people. Residential school survivors seek closure following the discovery of graves. And a bill in the Michigan legislature encourages Indian boarding school lessons. With these stories and much more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A Fairbanks, Alaska jury returned guilty verdicts Thursday for a man who killed a young Alaska Native woman in 1993 at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Stephen Downs was convicted in the rape and murder of 20-year-old Sophie Sergey. KUAC's Robin reports.
Sophie Sergey had been a marine biology student at the university the year before. She returned to Fairbanks from her tiny Yupik village of Pitkus Point in far western Alaska the last weekend of April 1993 for an orthodontist appointment on the following Monday. She stayed in the dorm with a friend who knew her from their time together in Native youth leadership organizations. She was last seen after midnight Sunday on her way to have a cigarette. She was found Monday afternoon in a restroom down the hall. She had been raped and shot in the head. The defendant, Stephen Downs of Maine, was never suspected of the crime until 25 years later, when DNA collected from the crime scene was partially matched to a profile in a commercial genealogy database in 2018. That profile was Downs' aunt. Alaska State Troopers traced the genealogy to Downs, who was living in the dorm that spring of 1993. Fairbanks Superior Court Judge Thomas Temple read the verdicts.
Murder in the first degree of SF. We, the jury, find the defendant guilty of murder in the first degree of SF, dated at Fairbanks, Alaska, the 10th day of February, 2022. Sexual assault in the first degree of SF. We, the jury, find the defendant guilty of sexual assault in the first degree of SF, dated at Fairbanks, Alaska, this 9th day of February, 2022, signed by the jury foreperson.
The victim's two brothers listened into the verdicts remotely from St. Mary's in the Yukon River Delta. Older brother Alexei Sergey said in an interview that he feels relieved after decades of uncertainty.
With the DNA, I'm pretty sure it's right, guys. Nowadays, DNA won't lie to you.
Alexei Sergey said he forgave the perpetrator decades ago in an effort towards closure.
I forgave him for what he did to me, but I'll never forget.
The judge scheduled sentencing in September. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
Sports wagering for Sunday's Super Bowl will be in full swing this year. Research from the American Gambling Association finds more than 18 million people plan to bet online, in person at sports books, or with a bookie on the matchup between the Los Angeles Rams and the Cincinnati Bengals. The Navajo Nation will soon get into the sports betting action. The tribe is teaming up with the Seminole Tribe of Florida's Hard Rock. They've joined forces to launch the Hard Rock Sportsbook mobile app in Arizona. John Chapper is Senior Director of Communications for Hard Rock Digital.
The Hard Rock Sportsbook app allows you to place bets on all the major sports. We'll have great promotions, also live betting. So if you see your team's losing, you think you got a big comeback in store, you can jump in there. Major sports, also some more niche sports. Soccer, you can do table tennis. It really just makes your game days a little more fun, a little more engaging, and allows you really to connect with the product on the screen.
Brian Parrish is the interim chief executive officer for the Navajo Nation Gaming Enterprise.
Really excited about our partnership with Hard Rock, with their sportsbook and Hard Rock Digital. They have an excellent team and outstanding product. Their value systems and their goals and objectives align very nicely with ours, and so it was a perfect fit.
Sports betting became legal in Arizona in 2021. The digital Hard Rock Sportsbook is expected to be launched in the state this month. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 17th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, so we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Lily Bolke, Eric Tegadoff, and Eric Galatis. The producer is Annette Newell. Our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website, kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell, glad to have you with us. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. So if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact. That's up next. Thank you.
This week on Making Contact, the magic of childbirth. Through the work and birth stories of midwife Allegra Hill, the producers of Rework Radio explain how Black midwives in Los Angeles are helping women to experience empowered births.
From the UCLA Labor Center, we bring you Rework. I'm Saba Wahid.
And I'm Veena Humpapour.
Each birth is a miracle, and I am fortunate to get to experience that miracle so many times. Birth continues to affect my life in the most wonderful way because it helps me stay in gratitude and stay present and experience the magic that is the introduction of a new person on the planet.
There's such a veiling around birth and labor and how much people know or understand. There's almost like a mystery around it.
I feel like there's so much we miss in terms of the work women do. Emotional labor, having a child. It's literally called labor, right? Like, women are putting a lot into carrying and having and caring for a baby. These are things that are so invisible in the world. One thing that's really beautiful in this story is the ties between women and the ties between generations. In Allegra's story, we focus on the generations within her family. We don't spend enough time focusing on these really special bonds